Welcome to Sacred Cheese of Life. This is Emma. This is episode 37, which is about this old sci-fi novel called Rim Runners, which I used to love and now I find kind of annoying. So let's talk about that, okay? All right, my settings are all off because I had to reinstall Windows and it was all a disaster and nothing is working right. And the microphone wouldn't work and nothing's working. I want OneDrive to die. OneDrive needs to die. It will not go away. I've uninstalled it. I've deleted it. I've done everything. And it won't stop showing up as like my file address. And I know I'm super old and I worry about things like file addresses. But it takes your stuff and it saves it somewhere you don't know about. And then you go looking for it and it's not where you thought it was. And that's just unacceptable. So I'm old school and it's making me completely bonkers. Other things making me bonkers are I finished Summerlands. Yay, Summerlands. Summerlands is done. Summerlands is published with errors. I haven't gotten the proof yet, so don't buy it. Not that you were gonna. But if you were, wait, because there's at least two mistakes, that a friend, my favorite reader in the whole world, she's such a favorite reader that I will spell it with a U if you want. Because that's how they do that, I think. Do they do that there? Anyway, favorite reader read it and loved it, and we're both very happy about that. Because it's a huge monster book. It's, what is it, 400 pages or something? It's massive. And she loved it, and I'm very, very happy. So thank you, Samara. You're the best. You're the absolute best. Do you know how great it is that I can finish a book and I can send a PDF to my friend and she reads it like right away? That's unheard of. That's unheard of. Oh, I'm so happy. Anyway, I got so happy that it was done that I got, I think, a massive migraine, but I get migraines without headaches, which is good, except it feels like you've completely lost your mind because you don't have a headache. So you're like, what's happening? So anyway, I had what felt like a giant galaxy-sized head that was iridescent, and I was all trippy and weird for a good couple days. I think I'm better now. Mostly still trying to kill OneDrive. I got my sights on you, OneDrive. You will die. I cannot get rid of it. I uninstalled, like I deleted everything off the hard drive and I saved it to my external hard drive, and then I copied it back in and I looked at it and it was like, yep, saved in OneDrive. I'm like, how? It's gone. I killed it. I really, really killed it. Like, it's not showing up anywhere. I will shut up about this. Anyway, happy about Summerlands, mad about OneDrive because I had it gone before and now it's back, you know, because when I reinstalled things, it was like, aha, here's my chance. I hate OneDrive. I hate it so much. Really, you should be able to have control over your own computer, and it's insisting that I don't, and that makes me irate. Absolutely irate. It's maddening that it won't go away when I want it to go away. And if you go online and look at ways to get rid of it, all of the discussions are like people losing their minds, just like me, going, why can't I kill it? Why won't it go away? And then they're all like, yeah, go use Ubuntu or something. I don't know. Use Linux. I'm not going to use Linux, you guys. I can't with OneDrive. I can't. Maybe if I set up iCloud, it'll stop. Anyway, Summerlands got done. Here's how that went. Work, 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 work. Holy crap, it's done. Now I have to format it. Spend the whole next day formatting it because that's a giant pain. Holy crap, it's done. Brain melts down and I feel very concussed. I felt concussed. If you've ever been concussed, had a concussion, you know how that feels, where you're just like, my brain is made of miso or something, like some gelatinous substance that light cannot get through, and I can't do anything. I also got an official job offer the same time, so that was a big day for me and probably caused the migraine. What a week. Summerlands came out dark. Bad things happened. People made, and this is something Sumara mentioned, a lot of stupid decisions. But that's like books I write. They're like bad parenting and stupid choices. You make the wrong choice. Sometimes you do dumb things and you're like, well, I'm in charge and I'm going to do it. And it happens. And then you got to live with it. And sometimes you can't fix what happens after that. And that's terrible. But that's also just kind of how life goes, right? Oh, so this book actually has adults as characters, main characters. And that's new for me. I don't usually do that. It's weird. It's a It's progress of some kind. So then immediately I started working on 40 Days and 40 Nights, which might have a different name now because I renamed the show The Girl's Obsessed With and also gave her this kind of dissociative disorder where she goes into, it almost looks like petit mal seizures, where she just like disappears. She's just like, you can talk to her and she won't hear you and she won't hear a loud bell and she doesn't react to anything and has to have like accommodations at school. It's like zoning out. And it is something I do, not to this extent at all, but it is something I do where I just like, oh, where have I been? I've been gone for a little while. But it's just I'm thinking really hard about something. So anyway, I made it times 100 and gave it to her. And she also comes out of it with, and this used to happen to me too, actually, now that I think about it. This is like when I'm like, well, I've never been in a car accident. Well, except for that one car accident. Or I've never been homeless, except for all those times I was homeless. Anyway, I never think things actually happen to me, but they actually do. Yes, I would come out of, I would be sitting in class, especially because classes are so boring. I'm really sorry, all you people like me who teach classes. They're boring. Nobody wants to sit there and just be a passive participant. They want to be active, which is why I make everyone talk. But I would sit there listening to lectures, especially. And in these small classrooms, like these little conference classrooms for grad classes, especially undergrad classes, I just wouldn't go. But grad classes, you have to go. And so I would sit there and it would be too hot. And it would be like, I swear the oxygen levels were dropping and the CO2 levels were rising because I would just be like gone and come out of it with a fully formed episode of a TV show. And that's something I did all the time in grad school. So maybe that's really good for writing. Like, get yourself in a really boring place where you have to sit there and you can't do anything else except write notes occasionally and look attentive and have a pen in your hand and sort of stare over the professor's shoulder. This is what I did. Right, and look thoughtful, right? Ooh. That's sort of my resting expression, like, interesting. And so, yeah, I would come out of that with an episode designed and built in my head. Plot. Like, I wasn't great at story, but I was great at plot back in those days. So that's what I would do. And so I gave that to her. So I'm developing this story, and it's already basically a whole novel, but I'm changing it drastically. So that was another big decision I had to make this week. Like, do I just finish it and make it this kind of like, you know, like middle of the road, YA, new adult, like figuring things out, sorting things out, making some mistakes kind of story. She doesn't even make big mistakes. And just finish it and go on and write this awesome idea somewhere else? Or do I rewrite it completely, adding in this amazing idea and giving her this dissociative thing and adding all of this stuff together? Like, it works for her. And I know this is something I write a lot, that people sort of dissociate via art. Like, it happens in The Nerve. It happens in all the Thrushcross books. Where else does it happen? What else have I written? Well, I wrote Landslide. That girl didn't really dissociate. She did study a lot of Norwegian, though. Yeah, I guess it happens in Summerlands because our girl studies Finnish and just zones the hell out of where she is. It's a really good way of not being where you are when where you are kind of sucks. It's also obviously maladaptive coping mechanism. Hello, it's one of my books. So ideally you wouldn't ideally you would deal with things instead of zoning out and being somewhere else. Mostly this is how I use fiction to disappear. And that is the connection with Rim Runners, because this is one of my favorites from olden times. Now it is not. And it's very weird to read it now and go, woof, really? Okay, so here's why. Okay, there's things that are tropes. And when you read the first one of them, you're like, new and exciting. I really like it. It's creative. It's new. And then you read 17 more and you're like, oh, it's just tropes. This is just a trope of the genre. We're talking about structuralism a lot. And one of the things structuralism works on is genre. Like, what makes a YA a YA? It's because it shares certain traits. Those traits, one of the things that makes a genre is it shares certain traits. And when those traits get listed and lined up, suddenly you have all your tropes. So what's in YA? We all know, right? People coming of age and stepping outside their youthful status quo and changing things and making big decisions for the first time and making stupid choices and making good choices and, you know, suddenly realizing, oh, I can eat macaroni and cheese every meal for a week, and then realizing, oh, I probably shouldn't do that. There's reasons why we don't do that. Or maybe you do it anyway. You just make sure you have an apple every so often. I don't know. You write your thing. I'm just making that up. Although it is true that every time I write young people going off to college, they're like, ooh, I can have all the mac and cheese I want. I'm gonna. Because that's often a trait of YA. It's that people have been living necessarily limited lives. Suddenly those limitations are removed. And they go bonkers in a bunch of different directions. They stay up too late. They don't go to class. They don't do their work when they know they're supposed to do their work. Whatever. You know, they just like suddenly realize, oh, walls are down. I get to decide. And when you get to decide for the first time, sometimes you decide wrong. It's how we are. So we're very good at seeing a line and going, oh, I'm going to cross it. It's not the best choice, but it is a choice we make over and over, some of us. So what else can you do, though? Because this is something I was just reading an old, a review I wrote of a novel years ago, a novel that I hated. And one of the things I hated about it was just hitting all those genre tropes. And it's a trope I don't read in. So I was just like, ew, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this? And it's something I also feel about freshmen, like, rather than just breaking a rule because you know the rule is there and you're now suddenly there's the walls are down and you get to do what you want, so you're going to break the rule. Instead of doing that, why don't you maybe decide what you actually want out of life and figure out how to get it, right? Long view, not short view. Ooh, I got the cookie jar is open. I get to have a cookie. No, figure out what you want and how to get it. And that might mean going to class, for example. So... This book made me so mad because it was just a bunch of, and this is the old book, the book I read years and years ago that I hated. I hated it so much that every time I see the author online, I'm like, ew, because why are you just really, when genre just trots out all the same tropes again, it to me is like a freshman who's like, I'm going to drink too much and not go to class. Like, you're just following the menu at Taco Bell. Stop it. Make your own decisions. Like, write your own book. And then, of course, you end up like me with my own Taco Bell menu, where I'm like, oh no, bad parenting and maladaptive coping mechanisms? No way. Someone's going to study a language they don't know and go somewhere else? No way. Anyway, you can't help being yourself. That's a fact. But we don't have to just pick the genre tropes from the Taco Bell menu and do them all just because that's what the genre is, right? We don't have to do that. We can be more creative. So this book, ages ago, this is the old book, and I'm not going to name it. How can I distinguish them? It's not Rim Runners, okay? It's a fantasy novel with a female main character written by a male author, and that can be problematic right there. It doesn't have to be. It can be amazing. But sometimes it's like, is this really what you think? Yucky. And that's when it gets gross, is when it's like somebody putting their own weird, like creepy fetishes onto somebody else. Like, this young woman never washes. She's always dirty. She's crusted with blood and actual dirt, like grime. And when that happens in a book, I'm like, why? Why? Why are you doing that? Nobody enjoys that. That is not enjoyable. That is physically unpleasant, right? We like showers. Showers are so nice. And maybe somebody puts it off or doesn't get around to it, or they can't or whatever, like if they're homeless or whatever. But writing this woman who is just carrying out all of these tropes from like 1970s sort of gritty, noirish cop fiction is weird. It's so weird. And the effect when I'm not from that genre is like, why are you writing this gross woman? Why are you writing her to be gross? She grows up with, okay, it sounds a little bit like something I would write. She grows up with an awful, controlling mother. She rebels by having sex with a boy. She gets pregnant. And then he commits suicide when she breaks up with him. And then his mother beats her with a snow shovel. So, like, it goes completely off the rails there. And she has a miscarriage. And it's all really bad. Like, all of that is really bad. And I could see, and again, I am aware who I am. I could see doing some of that in a book, but not the suicide and not the snow shovel. I don't go there. No. And I did write a character who had, well, thought they had a miscarriage, but didn't. They were just, like, being dramatic and stupid and telling everyone that they were pregnant when they weren't, like, okay. And everyone knows, everyone around her knows, but, like, I never made it text. It all stayed subtext. And so you can sort of, like, the girl suddenly is like, oh, I got my period. Oh, man, I had a miscarriage. And everyone's like, no, you didn't. Your period was, like, a week late. Nobody says anything to her about it, but she's being dramatic. Anyway. So here's this, all these stock elements in this book that I hated. Yuck. It's stock for a certain kind of fantasy novel, too. And I don't know why. Why do they like it? Do they like it? And this is why reading Rim Runners, I was like, why is it like this? Why is it like this? Like, is it cool and tough? And I think that might be part of it. I want this person to be tough and awesome. So they can survive getting beat up and be fine afterwards, and they always win the fight in the end, and they're tough and strong, and they get beat up. I don't think I ever write anybody getting beat up. I do have a character playing rugby, though, which is, we do get into how that's not unrelated. Like combat sports are not unrelated to getting beat up, because you do kind of get beat up. It's different, though. Okay, so I don't know. And I when I read this old book, not Rim Runners, I wrote that it's like the endless repetition of dirt, blood, bruises, alcohol, coffee, cigarettes, pain, bodily functions, and the occasional cheeseburger. It's always freaking cheeseburgers. Why? It feels like a book written by an AI that's loaded up with a specific set of fetishes. It's just like, again, we're at the Taco Bell menu. You know it's going to be made of beans and cheese and rice and corn in various combinations, right? What are the other things? Salsa. There's just, it's all various different combinations. And I don't, genre isn't like that necessarily. This is a bad genre book. So a good genre book will take that and make it into something awesome and wonderful. And you're like, way, yay, this is delicious. But a bad one will make it so that you're like, I had this yesterday. And maybe if you're starving, you're like, yay, food. And you're okay with it, but it's not great. It's really not great. So, okay, Rim Runners. Okay. 18 minutes in. I'm deleting a bunch of that. It won't be 18 for you. Rim Runners features a down on her luck space marine. It's already like, it's so standard. Like, it's a trope. Oh, it hurts my heart because I used to adore this book. And I think I used to adore it. Well, we'll get into that. Anyway, she's stranded on a space station. She got left there. She lost her ship, her marine ship, and got on a different ship and ended up here. She's trying to get back to her ship is her ultimate goal. But she also needs to get off this stupid space station because there's this whole system where if you take a local job, you get bumped off the list of space jobs. And so she won't. She won't take one. And apparently this is a thing that, you know, real space people are like this. They just won't settle for a station life. Okay, I can buy that. She keeps very clean on restroom soap. So she's scrubbed and clean. And like, there, we start with the point of view of this guy who works in the sort of unemployment office, helping people get jobs on a space station. And he notices she smells like restroom soap. And she's clean and she's starving. She's clearly very thin and frail. And she's starting to walk like an old woman. It says she's 37. She's tottering, right? She's weak. Because she's going hungry and she's not staying anywhere. She's sleeping somewhere. And this is a whole thing, like the station. And this got into my head such that I developed a whole series on this years and years ago. What's it even called? The Mercedes books. Mercedes was the character. Anyway, I can talk about that another day. But the station charges people for air and existence. And you have to be living somewhere and paying rent to live there. And she's not. She's a free consumer. And so if she gets in the system, she's in trouble because they're going to discover she's not living anywhere. And so she's like homeless on a space station. She's breathing the air without paying. And she's sleeping in a restroom. And she's really not eating enough because her money has started to run out. and she's in trouble. It starts off with her in trouble and like at the end, you know, she's at the end of her rope. And so this guy whose point of view we're in offers her a job cleaning up around the office, sorting the recycling, sweeping the floors, says he'll give her a credit a day. Just enough. I mean, it's enough so she won't starve and die, which is really nice of him. And she takes the deal. And then all of these bad things happen that day. Like she's weak, right? And he gives her like a cookie and a glass of coffee, a cup of coffee with sugar in it. And it almost makes her throw up because she hasn't eaten. Like she's at the end, right? She's in trouble. She goes to sleep in the, this is the day before, the very first day we're there when we meet her. She goes to sleep in this bathroom and this creepy jerk comes in there and tries to rape her. And she's a Marine. She fights him off and kills him with a kick to the throat. But then she's like, crap, now I killed a guy. Now what? And there's my fingerprints are all over the place, but you know, a person can use the damn restroom. So she washes the blood off in the restroom sink and stands under the hair dryer, you know, the hand dryer thing under the wall just to get warm. And it's all so living on the edge, right? And as I'm reading it, I'm thinking back to this terrible book and I'm like, so is she hitting the tropes? Because it is kind of this same, you know, tough guy down on their luck, living on the edge, barely surviving, but still tougher than anybody else, able to kill the guy who's trying to attack her. You know, it's just really interesting to me that this book, Rim Runners, hit so many of these same tropes that I hated when I read it in this other book. That was also a woman who was on the edge, down on her luck. Maybe it's just because she didn't bathe. I don't know why that would bug me so much, but it does. It's dysfunctional and gross. Like there's dysfunctional. Everyone I write is dysfunctional in some way or another, but then there's gross, right? Why does somebody need to be gross? But anyway, so I like Rim Runners, but it's still a lot of like it hits a lot of these tropey things. Reading it now is upsetting. Like you've got your loner, fine. You've got, she's stronger and better than everybody, fine. Even though she's starving to death, she still beats a guy to death in the bathroom. Okay. But then this is when the next day she goes off to this bar and there's this, no, it's the same night. I'm sorry. I did just read this. The same night she goes off to that bar, Rico's, and the bartender is like, you look kind of beat. You need a place to stay? And she says, yes. So he lets her go in his storeroom, whatever, behind the bar. And of course, he wants something in return. What does he want? Obviously. And she lets him. She's just like, I'm tired. And this is where it goes like, you just beat a rapist to death. You're going to let this creep mess with you? And she does. She lets him do what he wants to do. And she's just like, it's worth it for a safe place to lie down somewhere warm, you know, which is problematic for me in so many ways. Like she's breaking her own rules. And that's where it gets upsetting. And I remember lending this book to my dad because I was like, oh, she's awesome. She's so tough and all these bad things happen and she can overcome everything. And my dad was like, I don't like this kind of book. He handed it back to me. And I don't know how far he got, but I get why now he didn't like that kind of book. But when I was, how old was I? I know I was much younger than her because I was like, oh, she's so old. Now I'm like, whoa, she's so young. So I've been reading it over and over for like 40 years, but she breaks her own rules and that upsets me. But then, you know, this thing and that thing, all these things happen and she gets a spot on a ship, but it's a creepy spook ship. What's a spook ship? Well, there's this whole stupid background that I don't care about that I've never understood, even though I've read a dozen of these books set in this universe where there's like the Alliance and Maisian and Mallory and all these Pori. Who cares? I don't care. It's my brain shuts off when you start giving history. Anyway, there's some kind of like, there's the one people and the other people who left them and now they're at war, sort of. And this is a spy ship that goes around and works for the broken off people, I guess. Whereas her ship is part of the thing ship group. See, I don't care. I could not possibly care less. So she's on this spook ship now. And what does she do? She immediately has sex with everybody. She's just constantly having sex with everybody, which is, again, a trait of this older book I hated. Is that, like, why are you writing that? Why are you writing that? And even in the book, she's like, why am I doing this? And I was like, good question, Bette Yeager. Why are you doing this? Why is this happening? Why can't you get on this ship and, like, go to bed? Like, she doesn't get a decent night's sleep for, like, 3 or 4 days after arriving on the ship. And the first thing she does on the ship is this boss guy says, okay, scrub the deck. So she has to scrub the entire deck on her hands and knees all the way around. And it's just another, like, you know, that same thing with, like, oh, it's the guy who has to do all the hardest thing and he survives it and he's awesome. And but he suffers, he really suffers. But then he's really cool because he does it and he can do it. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing? So she does all that. She scrubs the deck and this crazy man comes up. He's obviously unhinged. Okay. He's nice and clean and good looking. Comes up, puts the moves on her. And she's like, whoa. This guy's actually giving me some kind of buzz, whereas nobody else does because of the creeps, you know? And so, like, why are we doing that? And it does turn out there's a good plot reason, and he ends up being important for that later on. But again, like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Is it just hitting all those tropes? Back to structuralism. Is it not a sci-fi novel without that? It would be. It would be. It could be. It doesn't have to do this, but it does this. And, like, why? I don't know. And it's just so much. And it just really upset me how much it was like that old book I hated, which I read much more recently than this. I mean, for the first time. Why do we have to do the things that we do in fiction? Are the rules, are the tropes of genre so important that we can't not do them? I don't think so. I just stopped to save this file, and I can't tell if it saved OneDrive or not. I'm so mad about it all over again. This is how you would wake me from a coma. I'd be lying there all, like, zoned out, and you'd be like, I installed OneDrive on your computer again, and I'd be like, ah! And I'd wake right up and grab you around the throat. I hate OneDrive so much. Ew. Ew. Hate it. Anyway, I'm calm. Ish. So anyway, tropes and genre. Yeah, it's problematic. And it's why people who don't like genre don't like genre, even though, as I've said over and over, every genre is a genre. Literary fiction has tropes. And that's one of the reasons I don't like it, is all those same tropes. And it's just like, here, we're going to hit the same chimes in a row. Bing, da-dong, ding, dong, dong. Ba-dunk, gunk, gunk. Why? Why do we have to keep doing that? And we don't. That's the thing, we don't. It is true that if you write a book, you probably got to write it in some genre, because you're going to put it somewhere and people need to know what section of the library to put it in, or the bookstore, or the online bookstore. Why? Why do we have to hit all the same tropes, though? Is it required? Is it like set pieces? It's not. I don't think it is. I really don't. And I mean, I was just reading what someone in class wrote about vampire things, and I hate vampire fiction. I hate it. I hate it the same way I hate fairy stuff. When they write it, you know, spelled F-A-E-R-I-E, and it's all these same, I don't know why this makes me irate. Well, I do know why. I do know why, and I'll explain why. They write all these same, like, oh, it's the Seely court, and, like, nothing happens, and no one's doing anything, and everyone's sitting around this big room. It's like the most death of plot thing I've ever heard. Like, nothing is happening. There's no story there. There's nothing. And everything writes that same kind of scene. And then they have, like, some queen or king. And it's all like, you're supposed to care, but they don't give you any reason to care because it's just in this thing, because it's always in this thing. That is how I feel about all of these things. All of these tropes, when they're overused and they're not done with heart. I guess that's what I want. I want heart. I want Bette Yeager, the main character of Rim Runners, to do things that matter to her for reasons that matter to her story. And when she's not, which she's really not most of the time, Like, there's no reason. Okay, she had to kill the guy in the bathroom because she had to get on the radar of station security somehow and cause a problem for her getting off the station onto her ship. That's a good plot reason. That's a good story reason. It also shows us who she is. She can be weak and practically dying, really, and still fight this guy off and kill him. That's awesome. We don't need the creep in the bar. We don't need it. We don't need it. And we especially don't need it because it's against what she believes in. She does not believe in treating herself that way. And that's very clear. And then suddenly she treats herself that way. That's upsetting to me because she's been set up one way. And then she's like, no, I'm not. Wait, why? Why? And she does kill that guy too eventually. In fact, she tells him, and I would have, if I were rewriting this, I would have combined all that. I would have made it into one scene where she says, you know, my ship is Africa. That's the name of her ship. And so, you know, you're going to die slowly, friend, or whatever she says. I could quote it practically from memory. So you know I'm going to kill you and you know it's going to take a while or something like that. She says this terrible, as soon as he hears her ship is Africa, he's like, you don't have to, yeah, I won't say a word. You can leave. It's fine. He just completely caves. It's terrifying to know you have an Africa Marine mad at you. And she does kill him. And she just, in the book, she stays in his, she kills him, puts his body in the bedroom, presumably in a million little pieces, and turns off the heat in there and stuffs towels under the door. Okay. I guess it's hard to get rid of bodies on a space station. So she stays in his apartment. It does give her somewhere to stay. Fine. But I still would have combined it and avoided the part where she's like spending a day and a half with this creepo and letting him do stuff when she clearly doesn't want to. Like, you don't have to have that in your story. You don't. And when it contradicts your character, it's a problem. But then, yeah, she does kill him and she stays in his apartment, eating his food and keeping his card active so nobody will look for him. So she's like going out and using it in vending machines. She doesn't walk into a restaurant, but she uses it in vending machines. So she gets enough food to eat. Yay. She has a warm, comfortable, safe place to sleep. Yay. She watches his gross videos, reads his dumb books. Yay. Fixes a sweater and takes it with her. So now she has a sweater because she's got nothing. She's got like a jumpsuit and her papers from the last little trading ship she worked on. She's got a little more than nothing, but she's also got a problem. See, that is a great story. That is awesome. I like that. She's doing something because it works for her in her plot and it works for her in her story. The thing with the creepy bartender doesn't. It doesn't. It's squalid for the point of squalidness, I guess. Squalidity. Is that a word? It is now. It's squalor for the point of squalor. That's the word. Does not work for me. And that is what I hated about that other book. I wish I could just name it because then it would be easier than constantly saying that other book. Squalor for the point of squalor, I don't get. And it doesn't say what you think it says. It just says like, you're still a teenager or something. Like, it's really not saying what you think it's saying. What in the world do you think squalor is awesome for? Why do you think that's awesome? Is it just she can survive anything? Okay, yeah. Maybe she could survive some other stuff. She's already survived basically everything. I don't get squalor for the point of squalor. In fact, I really hate it. So let's just put that on the table. Hate squalor. Down with squalor. Squalor is like the OneDrive of fiction. Hate it. It's in everything and it won't go away and I don't like it. Okay, so hitting all of those Taco Bell menu items when you don't need to, this is what I wrote about. It's like this. Sit in a restaurant with two friends who have a long shared experience that you don't have. You weren't there. Get them to tell you about that one time when they went on a trip to Kansas together. They're always referring to it, so now you can get the whole story. But no, they will devolve into just saying single words or phrases to each other and then dissolving into laughter. The pool, gales of laughter. The slide, more laughter. Then they'll say together, the buffet, and they'll laugh until they cry while you sit there with a polite half smile and alphabetize the sugar packets until you can pay the check and leave. Did you get anything out of that Kansas story they told? No, they did. They had a blast. You probably just felt alienated, but that's because they didn't actually tell a story. They just hit a bunch of signifiers that mean a lot to them and nothing to anyone else. And that is how I feel about all that Sealy Court garbage. I'm sorry to say that. If you love those books, more power to you. You can have them. You can have them. That is how I feel. It's like, say, it's just a signifier to say this is our stuff. And it's just a signifier to say this is what we do when we do this thing. And all I can, it's how I feel when I read another one of those terrible books, like that old book I read about another disgusting motel room and coffee and whiskey and sudden violence. All I think is, this is what he thinks is cool. It doesn't tell a story. It doesn't add anything about character. It doesn't further the plot. It's doing nothing. It's doing nothing. And I don't think we need it. We don't need it. I know we don't need it. Everybody knows we don't need it. And this is why when you hate a given genre, you tend to hate the same things that show up over and over and over because they're not telling a story. They're not. It makes me so mad. Not quite as mad as OneDrive does, but it's really close. Okay, so those signifiers that don't mean anything in a story, if you're a writer, they gotta go. They gotta go. You got to get rid of them. They're not telling a story. You shouldn't have anything in there that's not telling a story. You shouldn't have anything in there that's not serving character or plot or story. And when we get it, we get it. If you have already had somebody starving kill a man in a bathroom with her bare hands, then you're good. You've established who that person is. We're there. We're done. We get it. And maybe, well, like, what is she doing with all of the sex stuff? I don't know. I think it is playing tropes, and I think that's why it rings kind of false, like, and that such to the point where even the character's like, why am I doing this? It made me laugh so much when I got to that part, and she's like, why am I doing this? I'm tired. I haven't slept. Why am I drinking a lot and having sex in public? Oh, CJ Cherry loves to have people have sex in public. And then other people who are the uptight ones are like, oh no, we can't do this because they're from stations and the station people don't like that. But the spaceship people do because all the people live in one big sort of dorm barracks thing in all these sort of shelves on the wall, and they climb up and down the ladder, and there's webbing over the front so you don't fall out and all this stuff. And you have to be clipped in with a clip on the back of your pants in case they go to warp or whatever they do. I don't know what they call it, jump. And you always have to have a trank pack in your pocket because they could jump suddenly and you're going to need the trank to go through jump and not come out crazy, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, she has a thing about that and she keeps writing it. And it gets to the point when you've read as many of her books as I have where you're like, oh, here we go again. Why do you think, like, what is it trying to say? Is it just like, this person's cool and in control of their own sexuality? Yay. I mean, I'm all for that. But it's like, are there other ways to say that? Does she have to be doing it all the time to say that? I don't think so. And it is from, I don't have it. It's not right here. I'm trying to think of the year it's from. I think it's from the 80s. And yes, she wrote a whole lot of these books. And at one point I was like, I want to be like CJ Cherry and write a whole lot of books and have them all set in one universe and have it all like be high speed action and all these awesome heroines. Because go back to why I thought this book was so fantastic. Because this young woman, who in those days was an older woman, is in terrible straits. She's in dire straits, I was about to say. And she gets control of it and pulls herself out of it. She saves the day for everybody, in fact. And her skills come into play. Her skills, she's good with like armor and weapons. She gets on this ship and they're like, what can you do? And she's like, I'm good with small machining. Small machinist work is my work. And so she's like fixing pumps because she doesn't want to tell them she's a Marine because everyone's terrified of them. And she knows they're kind of the enemy because these guys are on the blah, 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 the other side of the Great Galactic War or whatever. So she doesn't tell them. So she ends up doing this dumb work. But then in the end, they're like, oh, we have this armor. Does anybody know how to make it work? She's like, I sure do. And she has to fit her worst enemy, this guy Fitch, who's like the lieutenant or whatever, in charge of them. She has to fit him in the armor. He's always beating her up the whole book long. He's bouncing her off the walls. She's the kind of person, she's like, I know how to make him hit me where it will leave marks so he'll get in trouble. Like, that's her kind of thing. Oh no, everything in this book is like sex and violence, like, but she always is in charge, and I guess that's what I liked. The plot at the end makes no sense. The plot does not actually make sense by the end. And it needs to be rewritten or something, because I'm like, what? And I've read it probably 100 times. But she just, like, it all kind of falls apart. And you're like, oh, it's okay. And she's in the armor and it matters. And the crazy guy, her boyfriend is the crazy guy, is also in the armor. And he's fine. And everybody's fine. And they land on the station where she was stuck. And there's the guy from the beginning. And there's the woman from the unemployment office. And they're so pleased to see her, and she's the conquering hero, and she saves the day. And it's awesome, and it would be more awesome if it actually worked so that it made sense. It doesn't. I'm not kidding, it doesn't. Like, I read it again, and I'm like, yeah. Because originally I was like, wow, I just don't understand this. But she saved the day, and she's awesome. And now I read it, and I'm like, that makes no sense. So that's a change. It's very, very cool to read the same book over and over, over a very long stretch of time, because you change, you get over some stuff, you get used to some stuff, you start seeing patterns that you didn't see before. I guess it's like when you're super into somebody and then you realize, oh, that thing they did, and this happens in Thrush Cross with Isaiah, it's like that thing they did wasn't just like an outlier. That's like them. That's like what they do. It's not an anomaly. It's a pattern. It's a standard for them. Oh no, I don't care for that. And if you don't care for it, when you first see it, you might be like, yeah, but, you know, I've only seen that once and it might never happen again. But then when you start to see it 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times, you have to admit you're being a dum-dum and you need to pay more attention. And maybe that thing is not okay. Maybe you need to get out. So there we go. I don't know what happens to her after the ending. Like, it's not clear to me where she's going to be or end up or whatever. I don't know. It's, like I said, the ending is it has problems. It really does. Oh, all right. You want to talk about 40 Days and 40 Nights, which is probably called something like Gone Away or Elsewhere or something like that. I have to fully invent the show she's in love with. It used to be kind of a fantasy thing, but now it's going to be basically Farscape. Kind of Farscape, only slightly more trippy, because the character, what happens is the character in it also can do the dissociative state thing that she does, but they go to another planet when they do it, or another like realm or something. So when it comes out, everyone's like, that's like you. And she's like, I know. And she's instantly in love with it. And it becomes her whole world. And she gets action figures of it. She's a child. She's in her teens. And when she goes into her zoned out states, comes back, like someone we know, with fully fleshed episodes and shoots them. She starts shooting them, at least scenes. And she goes the whole way, though. She'll start shooting scenes, puts them up on YouTube, has a lot of fans, and develops into shooting whole episodes. So she's doing the thing, and she learns how to be a filmmaker doing this, because you have to be, because you don't want the light to be garbage. You start learning, you want the, I'm obsessed with lighting, I'm sorry. You want the lighting to make people look good, and she learns how to do that different, like, you know, over the shoulder angle and reverse and all this stuff. You learn how to do it. If you sat down with action figures and two little light sources, you would learn how to do it too. It's not that hard, but it is hard when you don't know how, and she learns how. So she gets to college. She gets herself there by doing this thing, and she has nothing. She has nothing. This is a girl who was a foster kid. She doesn't connect with any of her families because she doesn't connect with people. She's anxious avoidant, right? She's like wary of people and avoids them, and so doesn't connect because she's afraid to connect. And, you know, that's a thing that I'm familiar with. So I gave a lot of stuff to this girl that maybe I've drawn from, I don't know, somewhere. And so she's got this thing she does that's cool, and everyone's like, hey, you're that girl who does that thing. Like, she's kind of well known for this, at least among nerd circles. And so she shows up as this completely dysfunctional person who zones out at intervals and is just absent. there's a thing called absence seizures. That might be what she's doing. But she comes out of it with, and this is the other thing I developed just this week. She also, she doesn't just think of show episodes. She thinks of episodes from her life that she would like to have happen or that she's afraid of happening. So she goes into this sort of like speculative state where she sees a scene play out with somebody the way she wants it to go, or the way she doesn't want it to go, or the way she's afraid of it going. And it's so vivid that she's not sure afterwards whether it happened or not. See why that might be a problem? Like, if you imagine having a huge fight with your friend because you're afraid you're going to have a fight with your friend, and then you see your friend and you're not sure whether you had that fight or not, problem. Not knowing whether your fantasy is reality or not is a problem. And this is something I have not experienced, thank goodness. But I had her with such a vivid sort of fantasy zone out dissociative imagination that it starts affecting real life in a really problematic way. Like, you can see how hard that would be to deal with when you're not sure. And this is psychosis, I suppose, when you're not sure what's reality and what's not. But that's usually not about fantasy states. That's usually about like just looking around and you're not sure what's real and what's not. So I'm not sure, but I need to read more about it. I was reading a lot about dissociation this week as I was in my post-novel release migraine and concussed feeling. And I was like, what is happening? And I looked it up and it was like, you're having a brain surge. I'm like, what's that? So apparently a brain surge is something that can happen with anxiety where you feel like that. You feel like your head is huge and full of bees or something. It doesn't say huge. Huge was just mine. My head just felt so large. But it feels like your head is full of bees or a thunderstorm or something. Like, everything's going on in there and you're panicking and you're wide awake and you're... And anyway, I was doing a lot of frantic, frenetic vacuuming and dripping sweat everywhere when I was in my huge head day. And I was like, why do I feel like this? And I skipped coffee and I was like, it didn't help. And I got mad at a stupid person online. I was like, ah, and just enraged. But I didn't act on it. So I was all proud. So I vacuumed and vacuumed and I had to stop and fix the vacuum 4 different times because, like, I got the thing, the attachment that lets you vacuum inside the dryer, you know? Like, I always clean the lint filter, but where you put the lint filter, lint gets by. And there was a lot down in there. And so I was vacuuming it out and it would come out these huge clumps, like bigger than an apple, hard packed lint and fur. And I was like, oh no, I was going to die of a fire if I hadn't fixed this. And it really is very dangerous. Lint is extremely flammable. So I kept vacuuming it out and it would clog up the vacuum and I had to get a knitting needle and unclog the pipe. And then the other pipe would clog up and I had to unclog that. And then I had to empty the thing. And then I had to stop and cut all the hair off the roller, my hair, because it was all like, it wouldn't even pick stuff up because it was all full of hair. And I was like, oh, I need to cut my hair. It was quite a day, but I was all proud because I didn't break anything or really freak out mad. I was just like in a rage, but not like just a powerful state. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to explain. I was just like in overdrive. That was when the migraine thing was really in full swing. It's been an interesting brain week. Finishing things is so good for you, though. Like, you know better than anyone how long and how hard I've been working on Summerlands. Although I started it, a friend of mine was just like, yeah, you were writing that in 2017. I remember. I was like, oh no. But I didn't start it in 2017 and I did not look. Should I look now? No, the things I have on this computer or even on my external hard drive, they don't show the older files. Oh, wait, I know a way I can look. Nope, that's not there either. Anyway, I can probably find it on an old laptop or something. It doesn't have the old Summerlands files. And I don't know how long it's been, but it's probably been 15 years since I started that, since I had the first idea. I think it was before I went to LA, though it's hard to say. It might have been after I came back and was helping out with home hospice. What a party. I don't know. It was somewhere along there. I remember where it was. It was in my parents' house in Pennsylvania. So I was there trying to finish grad school before I went to LA. And then I was there helping with my dad's home hospice when I came back. And it was one of those times, I'm pretty sure. So that was like before 06 or 08, fall of 08. Might have been. Hard to say. don't care. Nobody cares. It's been a really long time is my point. And I finished it. I finished it and I finished it. And I changed it so much in the process. And like the way it was originally is nothing, nothing like the way it is now. And I think that's amazing. And I'm very proud of it. Because making big changes to something you've written is hard. It's really hard because it says, oh, I did this wrong. And it's just really difficult to look at things where you did it wrong and look it in the face and go, yeah, I did it wrong and not feel bad. And then think, oh, I can make it better and then make it better. And I guess I've mentioned before that when I started writing, I had a really hard time with that. I couldn't look at bad work. I couldn't look at my own bad work because it made me feel bad. And I was like, ah, run away. Suddenly I'm way over there doing something else. But now I can. Now I can look at it and go, eh, I don't like that part. You know what would be better is this. And then make it this instead. So this week I read what I've been calling 40 Days and 40 Nights, which is a stupidly long title and doesn't really work. Might be called Gone Away or something. I don't know. Vanish. No, all those titles are taken. Gone Away is probably not taken because it's not great. So maybe I'll use that. Gone Away. Because she does. She just disappears. And that was not in the earlier draft. I read the whole draft, the older draft this week. It's like 100,000 words. It has some problems. Mostly the problems are it's just a boring story, like not a boring story, it's just like a standard story. So another reason I've been thinking about tropes, like it does all the tropes, and there's a lot of cool stuff in it. There's a lot of stuff that's not in it. There's a lot of, I wrote a lot of these scenes that are like, what are you doing? I read them and I'm like, these do not belong in this book. And that's when I had the idea that she should be having these weird zone out episodes where she's talking things over with her old therapist and she's going to see somebody and this thing happens and she's going to talk to her mom and this thing happens and none of that really happens. And that's really cool to me. Like, I just remember being knocked sideways by I Am the Cheese, that novel, I Am the Cheese. Do you know that novel? I need to get my hands on it and read it again because it changed writing for me. And that was 1,000 years ago. I mean, I was a child, but it made me realize the things you can do with narrative where you don't have to tell the truth and you can still be telling the truth, but it's not the truth, but the truth is the truth. Because you're telling it through lies. Know what I mean? So that's something important for this book, the Becca book. I'll just call it that because it doesn't have a name really gone away. It's telling the truth through lies. And that's something she's been doing all along with her little action figure movies, which is such a funny idea. It's like just like doing it with animation, but she's not animating. She's doing it with these action figures and, you know, altering her voice to do the different voices. Or stealing, you know, audio from the show and having using it again and different stuff like that. It's something you would do if you were an obsessive, solitary child who had a laptop and action figures and a phone. And that's like it. I don't know where she got those things. I suppose someone gave them to her. She has this relationship with her, a profound relationship with her therapist and her therapist's brother later. And he's a painter and she's always over there. And it's like her only adult person in her life who she can rely on is this brother, Owen the painter, crabby, cranky Owen. He's really cranky. He's got an injured leg. He can't walk very well. He's always using a cane. So he just sits on this stool and paints all day. And he's a famous painter. He's doing it. It's happening. But he's miserable. He's so unhappy. And she's sort of trying to help him. And once she starts helping him and he starts figuring it out, he's like, yeah, you can't come around here anymore. And she's like, no, that's not what I wanted. But it's good for him. So I get it. And I guess it's good for me. Ugh, I have to go live my life. It's one of those painful kind of growing up moments where you're like, oh no, I don't do what I want. I do what's best. No, I hate it. It's hard, but everybody does it at some point. So there's a lot of moments like that where she has to give up. She does kind of give up the little action figure show eventually. Realizes, I mean, she's in film school. She has to make actual movies with actual actors. She's like, I don't know how to do that. it. She's not a people person, but she has these friends. She made some good friends, and they're really wonderful characters. I love these characters, Michaela and Zeke, and there's some other ones. His roommate, Steve. There's Eleanor, who's named after my cat, who's this parkour girl who's way too privileged and gets to do whatever she wants. And that's really upsetting to a kid who comes from nothing. And her boyfriend, and Sunday, who plays rugby, rugby team captain. So she goes and plays rugby. Like all these, her world expands 1,000 different ways in 1,000 different directions. And that's amazing to see. And I'm hoping, I don't know, do you think she's going to give up the escapist fantasy zoning out thing? I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I haven't written it yet. I've barely written any of the zoning out yet. I think there's one. So it's developing. It's becoming a completely different book, much like what happened with Summerlands. Maybe I'm getting better at it. I don't know. Doing it differently, that's for sure. Like, it used to be so hard just to write a straightforward story in order. And now I'm like, that's not nearly enough. It has to be cool and awesome. And I did almost decide, just finish the book as it is, take out the weird, her weird fantasies, and just make it a book. And I'm like, but I want to write this thing. I want to write the thing where she's so busy imagining a different world that she's not living in the world. And I think that's huge. It's not something I would know anything about. I do think writing is like that and reading is like that. And maybe that's not great, but so what? You got to do what you got to do. And another friend just read Thrushcross. Yay, thank you. And said she liked the dedication to Maeswood, which says, thank you. Thank you to the people of Maine for the accidental 10-year writing retreat, which is true. I would have probably rather had life, but I had this instead, so I did this. I had a writing retreat, and I'm like, well, I'm kind of like the girl in the book, you know, like life gives you a laptop and nothing else. I guess there's dogs and cats. You do that. That's what you do. It gives you a bunch of young people learning how to live their lives. That's what you write about. And that's what I do. So there you go. You work with what you've got. And things are going to change sometime, maybe this week, hopefully. And then I'm going to have other stuff to write about, which is exciting. Because, yeah, that's a lot of books about the young people. It's just what I've got. I don't know. It's like those are the Legos in my Lego box. Those are the action figures I have. What are you going to do? It would be so funny if somebody gave her different action figures and she'd be like, what? I don't know these people. What's their deal? Like, you know when you get action figures from a show you don't watch and you're like, I don't get it. Because, and this is sort of what I've been talking about this whole episode long, like, if it's an action figure, you know, if it's my little Apollo from Battlestar Galactica figure, I'm like, that's Apollo. I know everything about him. I love Apollo. I can tell you all this stuff about his storylines and his history and his experiences with his dad and Starbuck and his brother and Duala and all, like, every, I have a whole story. It's there for me. But if you don't have it, you look at it and you're like, it's a guy. That really doesn't even look much like him. Whereas I'm like, yeah, I remember that day I talked to Jamie Bamber about how he was he was Archie Kennedy, and then he goes up in rank over the years, and he's like, yep, it's because I'm getting older. Like, oh, okay. I was like, I wish there was more Archie Kennedy, and he's like, yeah, but he died. I'm like, well, but, you know, flashback. Such a funny conversation. He's such a nice person. So anyway, I look at that little action figure and I'm like, yeah, all that stuff is in it, but other people don't see all that. And she has a world like that where any little action figure is just like an entire universe. All the stories are in it, all of the character stuff and the changes and the suffering and the survival and the relationships and the things they've done. It's all there in that little action figure. And someone else is like, it's a toy. Look, I'm going to make him fly like Superman. And she's like, no. I do like when people have objects that mean so much more than they actually contain. Like, you've invested all of this meaning in those objects. And this, again, is somebody who has practically nothing. Like, she has a skateboard and she bought some sheets that were the first household things she's ever owned. She has like 4 t-shirts. She has to get more t-shirts. Like she doesn't have enough to go a week without doing laundry. Well, she'll just wear them grubby. She doesn't care. But she's not fussy is what I mean. Like she's not like the girl in that bad book where she's filthy all the time. No, she's clean. She just will rewear her shirt if it's not gross. And she'll rewear her shorts and her jeans. This does remind me. Oh, no. I went to college with 1 pair of jeans and 1 pair of shorts. I just didn't have any money and I didn't know how to buy clothes. I didn't understand how you did it. Like I would go in stores and be overwhelmed and leave, which hasn't changed. So I just wore these same things and my jeans were too big. I lost a lot of weight the minute I started school again for the last time. The last 2 years of undergrad, I just lost a huge amount of weight right away because I started running and playing rugby. And so I just cut the sides of the jeans to make them smaller, like sewed them in to make them smaller, just altered them. It didn't occur to me you could go get different jeans that were maybe fit. Nope, just altered the ones I had. And I kept patching them, and I patched the shorts and the jeans over and over and over with all these different pieces of quilt fabric that I had around. So I still have these, and they are like artifacts of my life. They're such weird objects because I'm like, yeah, these are the pants I was wearing when these things were going on. And those are the ones I imagine, like those are the shorts I imagine her having. And they're just, they're objects with meaning. And I love an object with meaning. And I love it when somebody is just so minimal. She's not minimal on purpose. She's just like, look, I have to be able to move using a skateboard. I can't have a lot of stuff. I can't physically have a lot of stuff. Got my backpack with my laptop. Got my phone in my pocket. The action figures are in. And the little tiny lights are in my backpack. And I have to carry this tote bag with my my winter coat, because it's Maine. And you know, that's enough. That's almost too much. Like she falls because she's carrying too much stuff, you know, and she can't have more. What are you going to do? What are you going to do with it? But that's limiting yourself. Like she's doing that the same way she does the rest of her life. She's like, I can't carry all these people. What if I have all these friends? I have to, where am I going to put them? I can't go anywhere and take them. So what am I doing? Like just very limited. And it's fun to write. It's really fun to write. The Becca book is really, really interesting. She has to break that habit of not trusting or not letting people in. And then she lets people in. She's like, God, now I'm vulnerable. I hate it. Like, yeah, it's hard. It's scary and it's hard. And you're going to feel like you're not in control. Got it. Understood. And luckily she has a therapist in her head. I wonder if I can give them like head six, you know, from Battlestar. Where people have people living in their head. I think she does have head Maddie. That's her therapist. She's talked to her so much. She's got her in her head. Yeah. I did actually consider making her best friend imaginary. I'm not sure if I will or not. Because her best friend is supposed to show up for the first day of school. They planned this all together. And they've been separated by, like, you know, they're both foster kids. They get moved around. They go to different schools and whatnot. But they've been able to see each other a little bit over the last summer, but they were planning to go to school together. And the book starts with her waiting for her friend, and her friend doesn't show up. She goes and like eventually goes to the dorm, and she's like, hey, has so-and-so checked in? And they look at their list and they're like, nope. She's like, oh, where is she? She hasn't texted. So I wonder if she's imaginary. Imagine that, where she's so living in another world that she thinks this person's real, who she's made up. I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to do that. The best friend is a really problematic character. I'm sorry I keep overusing that word. She's not a good character, and she needs to change drastically and either become real and much more interesting. She needs a much different story, or she has to become fake and not real. And that's fine too. I just don't know which. It's tricky. Anyway, I have to make a lot of decisions. It's hard, okay? But the Becca book's going to be really good, I think, now that it's going to be just levels of awesome more. than it was before. That's good, right? I know the answer to that. It is good. If you have the option of writing a plain, boring book that's only one level or something with multiple levels, always go for the more levels. Always. It's better. It's more interesting. It's richer. It's what you should be trying to do. imagine if I hadn't put the mom and the stepdad guy into, and all that history into Summerlands, and I still am considering writing the novel about Tuuli and Stein because I've got so much material on their life together in Finland, and it just got deleted. I just cut it all out. I might still do that. I don't know. It's fun, and he's amazing, and you get to see her go from super broken to in charge and on top of the world, but I don't know. Who cares, for one thing? Except me, and I'm the only one who matters. I just get to decide what I write. It's fun. So maybe I'll have this book finished sort of soonish. I would rather get through it and get it done and get to move on to something else. It's been also hovering for how long? Not that long. 3-4 years, not that long. Because I would start it and then I'd go work on something else and I would work on it and it would go, I don't know. I don't know when I started it, but it needs to get done. Everything needs to get finished. You have to finish things. And sometimes that's really, really hard and you have to make huge changes, but you got to finish it. Really, really, really good for you. And also the opposite is true. Unfinished things are like poison. They really are poisoning you. They're not good for you because they're always potential and they're never complete. And once they're complete, you have to deal with that. You have to deal with, like, I did this thing and I think it's good. And that's a very, very difficult thing. And I remember putting those books out to begin with, being like, but what if other people don't think they're good? Who cares? They don't even exist as far as I know. Like, who cares? It's what you think is good. You do it the way you want. And yes, there's parts of it where I'm like, oh no, somebody else read that. Ooh. But so what? So what? That's their problem, not your problem. You do not have to make imaginary people like you. Be free of that problem. Be free of that. Let it go. First of all, you're not in charge of what they think. They are in charge of what they think. You're only in charge of what you think. So make it the way you want it to be. Make it good the way you think is good. That's all that really matters. Stand in your truth. And that is the story for the week. Okay, that's the end. Rim Runners, I don't know if I'd recommend it necessarily. For us all, it was like part of my foundational canon. I still don't think I'd recommend it for anybody who's not curious about it. I mean, it's not like, I mean, it's high tension, I guess. She's good at tension. She's very good at story tension, but I don't know, like, it's kind of yucky. It's yucky in those kind of fetishy ways I was talking about. I don't know why people write like that. I don't know. But anyway, that's on them. So you might want to read it if you're curious. She has other books that are, I would say, a lot better in storytelling terms. But there's still a lot of that, like, she has to do the thing. Like, okay. It's like a checklist. It's at a certain point, I'm just like, stop it. So I don't know. I look at that in my own work and I'm like, okay, fine. Well, I'll delete it. There. Good. It's gone. Good. Put that after the story ends. They can do that later. That's fine. Get over your emotional problems first, character. She has enough on her plate, for heaven's sake. So that's fine. I'll work on that. Yeah, so analyzing fiction is really good for making you realize what might be a problem in your own work, which is really helpful, very healthy. It's like therapy, isn't it? Literary therapy. Good, we've done it. All right, so send me an email, of course, as usual, at sacredcheesepodcast@gmail.com, and send me suggestions for what to read, send me notes, whatever. People have been reading and putting comments on Amazon, which makes me so happy. Comments on the books. What are they called? Like little reviews? Love that. If you hated it, don't. But if you loved it, please do. That makes me so happy. I can't even tell you. I read one and I went like this. Like I made that noise for a really long time. That's a happy noise. That's an excited noise. I don't look at reviews, but I noticed there were more stars. I was just checking to see if Summerlands was really up. And I was like, what are the, huh? What's that? And then went and looked. I was like, eee! That one's higher. Anyway, I was very excited. So thank you, person who did that. I really appreciate it. It makes such a difference. It's so rare to get feedback for all that I talk about. Like, this friend said this and this one said that, but that's like it. And these are books I wrote years ago. Although, favorite reader, Sumara, who immediately when I was done publishing the book, I was like, send Sumara the PDF. And she read it and it made me so happy. So happy. And told me when there are errors, which is always good to hear. Never change someone's name to the name of someone else who used to have another name. they both got their names changed, and I used the one in the wrong place. Anyway, have to fix that. Don't buy the book yet. So there we go. All right. Keep your eye on, you know, the sacred cheese of life. Bye.